The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
So I'm delighted to welcome Jason Foster to this week's show. Jason's the CEO at Ori Biotech, funded by the likes of Octopus and Amadeus, and also a venture partner at a couple of VC funds and an investor and board member at various SaaS and medtech ventures. So wearing many hats, Jason, welcome to this week's show.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Now, having founded three startups, what are the lessons that you've learned that you believe are universally applicable to entrepreneurs and startups, whether they're involved in medtech or SaaS or any other sector?
Just for clarity, I haven't founded them. I've been very early in the three of them. So I was second employee, fifth employee, and third employee. So I'm not the guy with the bright ideas, but I'm the guy that helps them kind of bring those ideas to fruition. There's definitely a need for both of those types of personality types. To your question, I mean, I think the universals are resilience, certainly as a kind of characteristic. You need to be really passionate about what you're doing. You need to feel like you're changing the world. Having that purpose underpinning what you're doing, at least for me, is critically important to retain that resilience. There's inevitable, you know, it's a roller coaster ride at best. Sometimes it feels like a crashing plane or something. There's only travels in one direction. My first startup blew up fantastically in 10 months, and I felt like it was more down than up. So I think, you know, you need the resilience to fight through the ups and downs. You need the realism that the odds are against you. The odds are stacked against every startup, and you have to be a little bit crazy to start your own business and to embark on this journey. And therefore, that kind of purpose and mission is really important to drive us through the hard times, because there will be hard times. But, you know, I wouldn't change any of the things that I've done. I think, you know, you learn a lot along the way. And for some of us, building things that are lasting is what matters. You know, I think I've been ruined for corporate life based on the experience I've had. I'd be a terrible employee in some large corporate venture. So there's a certain phenotype where entrepreneurs and, you know, startup venture individuals like myself thrive. And so make sure that you're one of those before you get too far into it.
After that first startup blew up relatively quickly, you said, you know, you were on the roller coaster, and seems like most of the undulations of the roller coaster were downward dips rather than upward trajectory. What was it that tempted you to get straight back onto another roller coaster?
I did have a bit of time to reflect. I went to business school in between the first one and the second one. You know, I learned some very critical lessons in the first one, which when I say them out loud sound ridiculous. Like, of course I should have known that, but you know, you need to have a business model that works. Ultimately, you're building a business, and there's all of this noise around startups and VC-backed startups. And when times are good, you can keep raising money. Sometimes the fact that it needs to be a self-sustaining business gets disconnected from the day-to-day decisions you're making. And so, you know, watching that first company blow up and realizing that actually the business model was never going to be viable made me want to have another go at it. And, you know, particularly in healthcare, where the challenges are big and the impact we make can be big. You know, the second business that I was involved in very early was a small molecule specialty pharmaceutical company that was focused in treating opioid dependence. So you've probably been aware of this issue. It's been predominant in the US as a major cause of mortality and a major public health issue. It hasn't been as significant in the UK, but it was, you know, you really felt like, you know, we could have a positive impact there. And we did end up having quite a significant positive impact. So that's ultimately what we're seeking. We're seeking, you know, no matter how many swings you have to take, you know, the situation where you can have a positive impact, have success, build something that's lasting. And then, of course, you know, realize the rewards of your efforts to, you know, make sure that your family is in a stable position, you know, financial position. And I was lucky. I was lucky with the second one that we achieved all of those things.
And focusing on Ori is all about enabling cell and gene therapy. So what inspired you to get involved in that particular area? And since you mentioned a few moments ago that you're not necessarily the the first person to start the business. You tend to be brought in as number two or number three. How did you kind of get connected with the founder or founding team and brought into the business?
So when I left my second startup, we were just talking about, we had grown to over a thousand people and, you know, over $1 billion in revenue. And it was a FTSE listed company, FTSE 250 company. And that journey, the business was quite different, obviously, from five of us in a room to 1,100 of us spread around 37 countries around the world. And when I left, I really wanted to get back to helping founders and investors build impactful businesses. So I started investing. As you mentioned, I've got a portfolio personally as an angel of over 18 companies that I have invested in personally. I sit on the board of four of them, advise many of them informally or formally. So really wanted to try and get back to working with people that have really world-changing, game-changing ideas and helping them be successful. So that was kind of my mandate in, you know, mid-2016. And was introduced to the founders of Ori in late 2018. You know, by that time I had seen something on the order of 4,000 or 5,000 different health tech startups. I'd invested in a handful of them, but there was something really compelling and unique about Ori. First of all, it was the mission of the company to enable widespread patient access to life-saving cell therapies. You know, there are in effect, there were in 2018 and there still remains today, cures for cancer that patients can't get access to. And they can't get access because these products are too expensive, they're too hard to make, and they're just a whole new category of living personalized medicines that we haven't had to ever deal with before. You know, this isn't stamping out tablets in a factory and sending them out through, you know, to Boots or Lloyd's Pharmacy. This is a whole different beast. And so the challenge was compelling. The opportunity to have a major impact was compelling. 10 million people a year diagnosed with cancer, another 10 million people a year die of cancer. And actually this modality is being applied beyond oncology in things like rare disease or autoimmune disease. So it has really broad application and an opportunity to make a huge impact with patients. And that was compelling. You know, I think the opportunity to have that big impact, but also it's just not okay that there are these cures exist and patients can't get access to them. So there was a bit of a mission driven, you know, if I can help fix this problem, I want to. And so I threw my lot in with the founders. I invested as a very early investor and signed on at full time as CEO about a year after meeting them in kind of mid to late 2019.
It's interesting to hear your story from meeting them to signing on as full-time CEO. Founders notoriously don't like to relinquish the CEO role. So I'd like, love to hear the human side of that, how the CEO, founding CEO transitioned out of that role and how you transitioned in and whether there are any, you know, emotional, psychological challenges for either of you in that transition phase.
Yeah, no, it's great insight because you're absolutely right. There is a lot of identity and ego associated with the titles in the business. And I give Farland, the founder of Ori, a huge amount of credit for being self-aware. And, you know, he and I had a conversation about all the things that the CEO needs to do for the business at the phase it was at and as it grew and the things that he loved to do. And he made the decision himself. I said to him, I'm happy to get involved. I don't really care what title I have, but, you know, there are these things that need to get done for the business. And he went away and kind of slept on it over the weekend and came back on Monday morning and said, you know, I want you to be CEO. And I said, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. But it really is down to him being a unique person who's very self-aware. He's our chief scientific officer. He's, you know, head of R&D. He's fantastic. He's the, I call him the creative engine. He's the visionary behind the business and its ambitions in the future. And an absolutely critical part, remains an absolutely critical part to the business. And we formed a great partnership. But I think you're right. That's a little bit unique. That doesn't often, it often happens that the scientific founder is pushed out by the investors or by the board and professional management brought in. And that automatically creates this kind of friction. But that is very, very common as well.
And how has the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, impacted the businesses? Have you changed your strategy or your goals in any ways? Have you changed the way you run the business from an operational perspective due to the lockdowns, et cetera?
Certainly, we all got very good at Zoom and Teams calls very quickly. And that, I think, has carried over for a lot of us. you know, we are trying to have the team be together if we can, mostly Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. You know, Monday, Friday, people often work from home. That kind of hybrid working seems to have become the norm. I don't know that I like it particularly. I like being together. I think we do our best work when the team is physically together and can really work off of each other's ideas to build the next interesting insight or idea. So, you know, we're trying to decide, you know, moving forward as we enter launch this year, does it make sense to have a headquarters where people go and there's offices and there's desks and there's labs, and does it make sense to invest in that kind of infrastructure or not? So it's a question we're currently grappling with. And that's, you know, a major change. But I would say also, you know, as I often say to the team, you know, Aurea has been forged by fire. You know, we've been through not one, not two, but maybe four or five black swan events in the last 5 years. You think about Brexit in the UK, certainly hasn't helped. COVID, as you mentioned, and then the ripples post-COVID of 10% inflation, global supply chain disruption. You know, you sort of go on and on with these things that have really impacted businesses, you know, our ability to recruit, our ability to retain, our ability to develop. You know, when semiconductors aren't available, it's very hard to make machinery. It's very hard to make equipment. Everything requires a semiconductor these days. So, you know, we've had to get through these storms, the meltdown of the markets, the freezing of the IPO and funding market over the last 2 years. You know, these things have made us stronger. We've been able to weather them. They've, of course, had an impact on our development timeline. I think, you know, had nothing changed, we probably wouldn't be doing our job and trying to adapt to the environment. But we've been able to extend our runway to get through commercialization and demonstrate our commercial proof points, which wasn't the initial plan. You know, the initial plan was to fundraise again before launch, but we've decided that that makes the most sense to launch and get the product in the hands of partners and customers. So we've had to adapt, and I think we probably will be stronger for it as we move forward beyond this period. Hopefully, you know, in 24 and 25, when things return somewhat to normal or the new normal, whatever that is.
So there have been these black swan events that have affected you in terms of supply chain and to some extent funding as well, with your plans to raise additional funding rounds. From a demand perspective, have there been any impacts there in terms of the type of customers that you're dealing with or the level of demand that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly our customers and partners are not immune to the macro. We work with small biotech companies, and funding has all but dried up for small biotech companies. So that's clearly going to have a cascade of demand, and kind of large players in our space like the Cytivas or Sartorius's or Thermo Fisher's have been talking about destocking and, you know, some of these trends for, you know, and CDMOs as well, about, you know, this kind of everyone sort of pulled in their ambitions, tried to streamline. Potentially they're doing portfolio reprioritization, focusing on only a program or two. Because of where we are, though, it hasn't really impacted our demand because we are still pre-commercial. We've got lead partners, so early access partners we've been working with for the last year or two. They're still engaged and working with us. And I think as we're coming out of that period, working towards commercial launch in the second half of this year, you know, the hope is that people will be again trying to invest in new technologies to really get their products into the clinic. That's why these companies exist, right? You know, that kind of biotech stage, getting first in man, you know, clinical data is a massive inflection point for those companies, and they need to get there or else die trying before they run out of money. So we haven't seen any lack of interest. Certainly there has been company, you know, consolidation and companies that have failed. There's still over 2,000 clinical trials happening in our area in cell and gene therapy, and well over 500 or 600 companies globally doing work in this space. So still plenty to run at.
And how do you balance innovation and risk management in a biotech startup?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's kind of inherent in startup life. I think every startup I've ever been involved in, and most of the ones I've invested in, have had a near-death experience. You know, it's sort of that thing where actually if that goes the wrong way, potentially that could cause the company to fail. So I think you need to be comfortable, you know, running pretty close to that potential negative outcome, because you need to take chances. You need to make decisions. You need to move forward. The key is remaining nimble, I think. And when you make a decision, being open to new inputs, new data points that might help you course correct or move in a different direction quickly. The real challenge is when we commit to a direction and then we sort of doggedly maintain that direction in spite of new information. That is often a company killer. And on the other end of the spectrum, not making a decision is a company killer. So I think you have to sort of balance the risk and the upside as you go through and retain that resilience we talked about earlier and that openness to taking on new data points to make sure that you're making decisions with the most valid data that you can possibly be using.
I'd love to hear an example of a challenging situation you faced as a board member at one of your portfolio companies and how you helped that company navigate through the challenges.
I'll give you two very real examples from the last 6 months or so. So one, oftentimes for very early businesses that you run into founder conflict, founder challenges. It's one of the leading cause of demise for a startup. And, you know, helping two founders or maybe more work through those challenges is something I'm doing currently and seeing if the company is going to survive potentially. Because obviously, like any relationship, being in a startup as co-founders or as very early partners, it's almost like a marriage. You spend probably more time together than you do with your spouse or your partner, certainly in those early days. And navigating that relationship and building trust and making sure that you've got each other's back is critical. And if you know that trust is breached, it can be fatal for the company. So that's an example, a very real example, something that I have done in the past and currently navigating with one company. And another is as a board member, you're often, and particularly as potentially chairman of the board, you're often navigating the competing desires or the differences of opinion between investors who sit on the board, the management team, and potentially other stakeholders. And so, you know, we've had a period in 2022 where several of my companies have either been forced to take a flat round extension or even a down round. And a down round can be quite painful if you've got preferred equity in the business. And I've seen many, many, you know, flat, but the shorthand for 2022 or in 2023 was flat is the new up. Flat was a good result. A down round was a more common result. And I think there's been a resetting of valuations in the market over the last 2 years. But there was quite a lot of pain and suffering as it related to that down round and a restructuring of the management team to really set the company up for success moving forward. And, you know, you have to have some hard conversations and understand where the company is, where it needs to go, the skills and perspectives that the current management team brings and where you need to bring in potentially other skill sets or other perspectives. And navigating that with one of the portfolio companies over the last 6 months has been challenging, but I think the company has landed in quite a good place and is set to poised to grow again. So that's an exciting outcome. It doesn't always work out quite that well, I would say.
Now, clearly you've had a lot of impact on the people you've worked with and for and the companies you've invested in. Tell me about the gurus or mentors who've had a significant impact on you and your professional journey and continue to inspire you.
No, it's a wonderful thing to think about. I'm quite a student of business and management. I read a lot of management books, as my kids call them, boring nonfiction books. My kids are quite into dystopian fiction. So that's kind of the other end of the spectrum from boring business nonfiction books. But nonetheless, I mean, I think I've the books and the authors and the sort of operators that I have read a lot about and have learned a lot from are people like Reed Hastings, who founded Netflix. He wrote a book called No Rules Rules, which is the only business book I've ever read cover to cover, and then flipped it over and started reading again from page one. I think it's one of the better studies of building a high growth business, retaining a highly talented team. He coined the term talent density, which I use with our team quite a lot. So I've learned a lot about building teams and managing teams from that experience that he articulates in that book. Another would be a guy called Daniel Pink, wrote a book called Drive, which really talks about intrinsic motivation, what motivates people. And it's actually not the things that we think motivate people. You know, we think that big bonuses motivate people, but carrot and stick incentives, as he describes them, are actually cause worse performance rather than better, the evidence would suggest, which blew my mind the first time I read it, because every single business I've ever worked in had carrot and stick incentives. KPI-driven bonus schemes would be an example of a carrot, but it creates all kinds of perverse incentives for people, which causes us to be less effective, less efficient than we thought. So those are two examples of people that I've studied and read a lot about, read a lot of their work. And one is an example of someone who I know, you know, IRL in real life, a former kind of colleague and mentor of mine, a guy called Adrian Norton. Adrian and I have worked together for 20 plus years. He's a practitioner in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, which really has taught me, and I'm not at all a practitioner, I'm merely a student, but about different characteristics, different types of people, how they respond, how they interact, how they influence each other, and the kind of art and science of building relationships. And ultimately, because that's what you're doing, you're selling, when you're raising money, when you're, you know, building a partnership or talking to a customer or a partner, you're selling, you know, you're selling your vision of the future, you're selling your business, and you need to be very good at those things. And it's the human beings that make the difference. So ultimately, having that skill set and understanding why people react in certain ways or why they react to you in certain ways is critically important, and building that self-awareness. So those are some of the lessons and the student and the teachers that I've had in my career that spring to mind when you ask the question.
And since you're, to use your own phrase, a student rather than a practitioner of NLP, in practical terms, how does NLP shape the way you're engaging with people, and how consciously are you applying NLP ideas, or is it more just subconscious sitting in the background of your engagements?
At this point, it's probably more subconscious than conscious. Once you've been at it for 25 years, I guess it comes kind of into your DNA. But and actually only maybe in retrospect did I realize that what I was doing actually had its grounding in some of those principles. So, you know, there's a question around, or there's a sort of thesis around building rapport. How do human beings connect? And as Adrian says, people who are like each other. Maybe you've been to a dinner party and you've said, "Oh, you went to Oxford? I went to Oxford too. When were you there? Oh, do you know so-and-so?" We're all trying to find some commonality with each other. And this is a way in which we build rapport. And there's a kind of formula for doing this, actually, when you look at it in NLP terms. So, you know, it's these kinds of things when you're on a Teams call and I notice something in the background, maybe it's someone playing golf or fishing or traveling on a, you know, hiking on a mountaintop. You can say, "Oh, where was that? You know, I love to travel too. And I love adventure, you know, as you and I were talking about right before this. I like adventure holidays as well, and traveling to exotic foreign places. I've been to Brazil, and not quite as exotic as you have, but I think those kinds of things build shared experience and shared perspective, which help us build rapport and gain a foundation of trust to build a relationship on. And those are super important. So these are the kinds of things that either prospectively or retrospectively, I realized that I do in kind of weaving some of these practices into my daily life.
And when you're putting teams together, this idea that people like people like them, the counter to that viewpoint is you get too many people with a similar perspective and you get a lot of groupthink in an organization. So how do you square that circle when you're building a high-performance team?
It's a very interesting question, and one that I've learned the hard way, I think, over kind of 15 years of building teams, is I have to trust my team to hire the best people that satisfy the needs of the business. And whether I believe that that hire or that person fits or is exactly the right person is maybe less important as to whether the actually hiring manager and their team view them as the right person. So one critical mistake that I made early in Ori is, you know, I wasn't necessarily as bullish on a candidate that we were interviewing, and the team was pounding the table for this individual and they've proven to be a superstar. And what I realized in retrospect was, you know, maybe this person was a little bit more reserved, a little bit quieter than I am or than some of the other members of the team were, but they're adding huge, huge, huge value, one of the superstars in the business. And so, you know, not letting my own biases as to what good looks like, and they don't need to be cookie cutter versions of me, certainly, to be a success at Ori, and making sure that those inherent biases are not present in our screening, hiring practices. We've done a lot on diversity, equity, and inclusion over the last couple of years in Ori. At one point, we had an all-male leadership team, essentially, which we didn't like. We didn't think that made sense. And so we've worked very hard to make sure that we're inclusive across the business and working hard on that, being conscious of it. So these are the types of ways in which you avoid generating a team that's going to be subject to a lot of groupthink.
Yeah, those would be really important learnings. Awesome. Well, Jason, thanks so much for sharing with me your undulating journey, your roller coaster experiences, and your vision with me on today's show.
Thanks again. And if anyone out there has an interesting business and, you know, wants to connect, please reach out on LinkedIn. I'm very happy to hop on the phone and hear more about the exciting things that you're up to.
Absolutely. And you're on LinkedIn, you're down as Jason C. Foster. I think
indeed.
That's how they can find you.
The C is for Charles, just because there's a lot of Jason Fosters out there. So,
okay. That'll make it easier for people to find you. Awesome. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.